Pacific Mornings on ABC Radio Australia.
Good morning to you, Jahan, and welcome to ABC Radio Australia Pacific Mornings.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Nice to have you in the studio with us. Now, can we go a little bit back in your career? You were admitted to the New South Wales Bar Association at the age of 25 after already forging a successful career in finance. Why did you decide to go into law?
I've always been very interested in the law. I've always been fascinated by the ability of the law to give a voice to people who may not necessarily have one. I was very lucky in finance. I was given a lot of mentorship and guidance by some really wonderful people. And I learned sort of how a strong team works. And I thought, I enjoy finance, but it's not me. I was still searching for something. And I think the law gave me the opportunity to sort of find my voice and how I could use that to help others.
Was it an easy swap, though? Did you have a long list of things that you could possibly consider and law was one of them? Or was the very strong focus on switching to law?
Well, it was definitely, I think, the thing that drew me in. I did look at a couple of other options, but it was something that has always sort of called to me. I was always pretty good at debate. I was always a little bit skeptical of authority, and I was always a little bit cheeky. And I thought, I wonder if there's something to be done by using this skill set to help others. And the law kind of gives you an opportunity to do that.
Did you have to study law while you were still working, though?
I did. So it was a challenging time in my life. I was going to night school studying law then, but I was also working almost full time. But I actually had a very flexible working arrangement at the time, and it was facilitated by really wonderful people I work with.
So far, with the changeover to law, are you happy you did what you did?
I am. I'm one of the lucky people who gets to do what they really enjoy. I mean, obviously, not every day is ideal, but more often than not, I wake up with a big smile on my face.
Let's talk then a little bit more about your job. You established and became a partner at the firm Executive Legal, where you head up the serious crime and mental health practice. Can you give us an insight into your day-to-day job?
Look, every week is a little bit different. I'm always a get-up-and-go sort of person, so I would feel a bit silly if I just had to do the same thing day in and day out. But an average week would be maybe 2 to 3 days I'd be going to court. A day would be conferences, meeting with clients, going through matters, maybe meeting with barristers, preparing briefs. And more often than not, a day is probably spent working with legal aid. I'm really lucky that I work very closely with legal aid, and I often appear on behalf of people who have mental health issues at the Mental Health Review Tribunal, which means I go to hospital, I meet patients who may be detained involuntarily, I speak with them, I let them know about their rights, and I sort of help them through that process.
How unaware are most people of their rights?
Surprisingly, it's getting a lot better, but as a general rule, we have a lot of rights that we're not aware of. I teach administrative law at the university, and even law students who are, very, very clever cookies often don't know how far our rights go. The people who've established this country and the judiciary have done a great job of giving us a basis for which a lot of our lawful actions stem from, and it really can be amazing how ignorant we are of the laws. I'm forever learning about laws and rules that I didn't know about. So if I'm learning about it, everyone should be learning about it.
But you're even surprised when you're preaching to the converted, as it were, to law students who should have an idea or an insight. They too sit there and go, really?
Absolutely.
Is that because the law is an evolving thing? Sorry to cut you. Is that because it's an evolving thing and changing, and there's new legislation and all that sort of thing all the time? Is it challenging to keep up with those changes?
It is. The law as a body of work is one of the most interesting things to me. So right now, our Chief Justice is Susan Kiefel, who's an amazing lawyer and heads up the High Court. Now, women only gain legal status to participate in Parliament and as lawyers 100 years ago, in 1918. Mm. So when you think about how short a period of time that is in real terms, and what advances and changes have happened to the face of law in that time, that's something that really should and does impress me.
Which cases do you find the most rewarding?
So I often stand behind people and beside people on one of the hardest days of their life, when they've made a terrible mistake or when they stand to lose everything. And a lot of those people are at crossroads. And sometimes you get to see that person make the right choice at the crossroads. You get to stand up for them and advocate for them. And you then get to sometimes follow them on from that. And I've had a few cases like that where I have witnessed somebody realize, look, this is really the only shot I've got, and they've grabbed it by both hands and moved forward with it.
Can I take you to a different direction now? You've spoken about being verbally abused in the wake of the September 11 terrorist attacks. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, look, I'll never forget. It was a Wednesday, and I was 13, and it was almost a surreal time to be somebody who didn't fit cleanly into the Australian diaspora. For you, obviously, for your listeners, I'm of Iranian heritage, and I look Iranian, but I've been here since I was one. I'm thoroughly Australian in my eyes, and anyone who knows me knows that, you know, that's who I am. But there was a really awful period where I know that myself and other people like me were being abused. We were called terrorists. We were, you know, people were being very, and you know, I'm 13 years old. It's not like I'm old enough to defend myself and understand these things. And you start to build these very negative conversations around it. And as I've gotten older, I've realized, you know what? I want to be part of a group that opposes that. I want people who are perhaps marginalized, who are perhaps told that they're different from society, to be told that that's not the case at all.
Hmm. It was a very surreal time for all of us. Anyone who happened to be awake on that night when the news, television channels all switched over to this news coverage, you were going, what are they showing here? Is this scenes from a movie or something? It took me, because I was up late that night, a little while to get my head around the fact, no, these are live pictures from New York, and everything that happened in the days, weeks, months, and years that followed were, for want of a better expression, surreal for all of us. But there was that extra level or layer for you to deal with. Were you amongst young people of your own age feeling the same thing, and was there a sort of solidarity you were able to form to support each other?
Well, look, at the time, it really wasn't that case, but I'll give you a good example, Tony. What occurred after September 11th and what I learned then, which has really informed my legal career, is all it takes for people to lose their minds is for a incident that occurs. It's very easy for us to devolve quite quickly into us versus them. So in the wake of the horrific actions at the Lindt Cafe, a similar sort of thing happened. I wasn't personally verbally abused on that occasion, but a colleague of mine, a very dear friend of mine who's a doctor, you know, he was verbally assaulted. Somebody, you know, wanted to have a go purely within, I think, the evening of that incident happening. And it just amazes me how quickly we can go from being one body of Australians to us versus them. And that's the thing that I really try to stand up against.
Jahan Kalanta is a Sydney-based solicitor, university lecturer and entrepreneur who, at the age of 25, a successful career in finance, decided it wasn't quite the thing he wanted to be doing and studied accordingly to get himself a law degree. And he's with us this morning here on Pacific Mornings. What are your thoughts, Jahan, on Australia's treatment of migrants and refugees?
I think that no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, we can do better. We can absolutely do better. Australia is at an interesting crossroads right now as to how we're going to deal with the issue of the fact that the face of Australia is changing. Now, we can either be fearful or we can be embracing. That is the beauty of Australia. Australia is a welcoming country. It's designed so that everyone should be allowed to come here. And if they do come here and they're willing to contribute to society, then there's a place for them. That attitude, I think, is prevailing. And I think it's an independent attitude that comes down to the individual. I think on an individual level, Australians, because we have so much interaction with one another in our multicultural society, we eat with different people, we sit on the bus with different people, we chat with different people in elevators. So there is a mentality of multiculturalism, which is beautiful, which unless we start to embrace and acknowledge, we stand to lose. And what a loss that would be.
Hmm. We often hear our senior politicians describe Australia as the most successful multicultural country in the world. Do we have any idea how that's assessed, how they come to that conclusion? I often ask myself, but where are the KPIs for that? How do we know that?
Well, look, that's a really good question. I think from an objective standpoint, it would be an incredibly difficult thing to measure. I personally think that the way that we should measure the success of our ability to integrate is not by how well, you know, individual business person X can succeed given their background, but rather how the lowest and the weakest in our society, how people who've come here with nothing, how they've been able to rise, what opportunities they've been given. That's, to me, the successful indicator of a society moving forward. What we do for those amongst us who have the least.
There's been a lot of talk lately, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, about areas becoming dominated by people of a certain background. And you talked there before about interaction in our multicultural society. Is that perhaps the key to reducing the ignorance equals fear as far as refugees and immigrants are concerned? We just need to interact more rather than just perhaps try each other's food as a takeaway?
Absolutely. Look, it's interaction. Ignorance leads to fear, I think is the simple way of putting it. But the way that we avoid ignorance is just by spending time becoming aware of other people's cultures, becoming aware of other people's attitudes and their beliefs. It's about having the opportunity to talk with them. We're quick to stereotype people we don't understand.
Mm.
Rather than getting to know them. And it's understandable. We live in an incredibly complex world and we all yearn for simplicity. But in Australia, we have those opportunities. There are places in this world where you will not meet people from all corners of the world. That's just the way that it is. And you may very well live your whole life not meeting anyone who looks or acts too different from you. But here in Australia, we have that opportunity. So embrace it, reach out, grab it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when we travel overseas, part of our purpose is to immerse ourselves in another country's culture. It's food, it's people, it's geography, the whole sort of thing. Yet we don't seem as brave, as it were, to do the same thing in our own backyard with people who are different to us.
Absolutely. I think that when we go on holiday, we embrace this attitude of, I'll try this new thing, I'll do this different thing, I'll get out of my routine. But it's very easy when you're in a routine to, you know, not want to shift it and not want to change it. I'm not advocating that everyone has to go out there right now and hug a complete stranger and, you know, have these deep, meaningful dialogues with everyone that you don't know, especially if you're not a particularly outgoing person. But what I am advocating is that before we write people off, before we quickly dismiss people as being different, we give them a shot.
Mm.
We give them an opportunity.
Don't make assumptions because
Absolutely.
It's going to be very dangerous. I mentioned earlier that you will have the opportunity to speak at TEDx Sydney shortly. How do you feel about that opportunity?
Look, I'm really honoured. I'm very, very... I'm quite nervous, to be honest, but I'm excited as well. I really am very lucky that I've had the opportunity to participate in this. The people at TED are absolutely wonderful. It's been such a pleasure working with them and basically learning how they do what they do. They put on such an amazing, wonderful experience for us, and I'm really excited. I think it's going to be a great day.
Do you have a theme for your address, and ultimately, what would you like your audience to take away from listening to you?
Well, the TED theme this year is humankind, and all of the talks sort of touch on humankind, what it means to be a human. I am trying to make sure that in my talk, it's going to be about communication broadly. And I hope to give people some practical takeaways. I've had the benefit of helping people when they need it the most. And through doing that, you start to see some patterns come up, which have really helped me in my communication. So I've tried to distill that down, Tony, into sort of some helpful takeaways for others.
Can you tell us, too, you mentioned before your Iranian background, how does that inform everything that you do?
Being from that diaspora, being from both worlds and not belonging fully in either, is a really interesting sort of uniquely Australian thing. I used to think I was quite special in that, but as I get older, I meet more and more people who are first generation Australians who are Australian as it gets, but may look different or may come from a different cultural background. And I think that it informs me in a way that it gives me an insight into what it's like to be from a community that could be potentially marginalized. Mm. I was blessed. I have wonderful parents, both are doctors. They worked so, so hard. They were community leaders. My grandfather was a community leader and organizer. And I really got to see the impact that that can make. So it really gave me the opportunity to see people in my community who maybe didn't have a chance to be heard and wanting to give my voice to them.
Finally, what goals are you yet to achieve? Got any grand plans on the horizon?
I think that we are kind of living in a golden age right now. And if I've said anything that sounds pessimistic, I really want to clarify that that's not the case at all. I'm actually deeply optimistic about the future. One thing that's currently come into the limelight is mental health. I'm a very passionate supporter of mental health advocacy and speaking on behalf of people who have mental health challenges. What I would like to see is that brought into the conversation in a more easy, understandable format. Leaving clinical issues aside to clinicians, I would like to be a bigger part of that dialogue. I don't know how yet, Tony, but hopefully that's somewhere that I can see myself going in the future.
Well, keep on going in that direction. Far from pessimistic, I've found you inspiring and thought-provoking this morning. I think there's a very positive aura around you. So more strength to your arm, as we like to say, to those people who are on a cause like you are. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. Do appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
Jahan Kalanta, Sydney-based solicitor, university lecturer and entrepreneur, my guest this morning here on Radio Australia, Pacific Mornings.
Pacific Mornings.